Okay. Hi, my name is Ariana Ramsey, and I am in Hitchcock right now in Hanover, New Hampshire, on Mass Row. And I'm doing a Zoom interview with James Hutchinson, who is in Chicago. Today is October 30th, 2022, and this interview is for the Dartmouth Black Lives Oral History Project. Okay. Hi, James. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. How are you doing?
Fine.
Good. So first, we're going to start talking about your childhood. So can you please state where and when you were born?
I was born on September 22, 1947 in Chicago, Illinois. I'm a twin. I have a twin sister, Dr. Janice Hutchinson.
Nice. Can you tell me the names of your parents?
My mother was Dorothy Hutchinson. My father was James Hutchinson Sr.
Okay. And what was it like growing up in your town?
We thought we had a good life. When I say we, my sister and I, we grew up in a community in Chicago called Morgan Park. And it was an ancillary community in that it was a community.
First of all, it was all black.
Because we're pre-desegregation. It was on the far south side of Chicago. Lorraine Hansberry, who was the author of the play Raisin in the Sun, also grew up in Morgan Park. There's a reference to Morgan Park in the play where the mother says, "I've always dreamed about living in Morgan Park." It was a community that was primarily made up of residents that were either government workers, Pullman porters, a black community that I guess by today's standards would be considered middle class. It was all primarily homeowners.
Nice. And did your parents go to college at the time or?
No, my father was born in 1896. The furthest grade he went was seventh grade. In Paducah, Kentucky. My father was born on the border between Alabama and Georgia. I think it was West where he was born, but they were just hard workers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, awesome. So with your upbringing, like, did you know that you wanted to go to Dartmouth?
I didn't know what Dartmouth was. I was recruited by Dartmouth in my junior year, primarily to play football. Recruited by some other colleges. Our football team, I went to Morgan Park High School. Our football team was one of the best in the city. It was a primarily white high school, public high school in Chicago. Matter of fact, graduation class, there were 400 of my graduation class, of which only 25 were people of color.
Okay. So how long did you play football when you were in high school? How many years?
I joined the team in my freshman year. So I played my
till after
the tryouts were completed. And went in to show the coach my report card. And based on him looking at my report card, which said all A's, and I was generally in the honors courses, he let me on the football team.
Okay.
because I didn't feel the physical prowess, but I later developed that.
Okay, nice. So you got recruited at Dartmouth. Did you guys, at the time, were you guys doing visits on campus and things like that?
No. I was recruited by Dartmouth and also Brown as far as the Ivy League school was concerned. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what Dartmouth or Brown was. It could have been a junior college. Mm-hmm. I had not until I was first approached the freshman coach at Dartmouth.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you had no idea what it looked like or what it was like before you came there?
That's correct.
Okay. Awesome.
That's correct. My father was 53 years old when my sister and I were born. Mm-hmm. And he was 67 when my sister and I graduated, or closer to 70 when my sister and I graduated from high school. My mother went to, with my sister, who went to Stanford. Father came with me when I entered Dartmouth. My father was a Pullman porter, so we had discounts on various railroads.
Okay, awesome. So you visited Dartmouth, and that was like the first time you saw it. It was like your freshman year.
That's correct.
Okay. So what were your first impressions when you got here?
It was starkly different than Chicago, which is a city of people. Mm-hmm. Going to a community at that time of Hanover was approximately 5,000 people or less. So it was a traumatic experience.
Mm-hmm. What in the culture difference? Was it much of a difference as far as culture?
Well, drastically, I was used to going to school where I was in the minority in terms of my high school. Of being only one of 25 black students in my class in high school. I was used to going to school with white folks. But I was not used to a community as small as Hanover, New Hampshire.
Right. Do you remember which dorms you stayed in when you were here?
During my freshman year, I had a single room in Russell Sage Hall.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And during my sophomore year, a gentleman by the name of A.B. Willacy, he was class of 1967. He agreed to room with him in Mass, which at that time was one of the nicest dorms on campus. Mm-hmm. And ironically, he left the term early. He left after the completion of the winter term. I the room. It was very, very nice room. Ultimately, one of my classmates, Ron Talley, asked me if he could room with me, and I told him yes. And what I mean by one of the nicest rooms on campus, it had an indoor bathroom, an in-room bathroom. We were, I think the room 12, we were a half a block from Thayer Hall, the dining hall, and just a block from Main Street.
Yeah, that's where I live on Hitchcock and Mass Row. I think it's the best location, honestly.
Yes.
So you said A.B. Willacy. Is that W-I-L-L-I-S-Y?
W-I-L-L-A-C-Y.
A-C-Y, okay. And Ron Talley, R-O-N-T-A-L-L-Y.
A-L-L-E-Y, Talley, Ronald Talley.
Okay, nice.
A-B, we used to call Aubrey A-B. A.B. was from Shaker Heights, right outside of Cleveland, a suburb of Cleveland. And Ron Talley was from New York City.
Okay, nice.
Ron was class of 19, and A.B. again was class of 1967. A.B. went on to become a lawyer. He went to Howard. He graduated from Howard University Law School. And Ron Talley became an educator. And for several years after graduation, Ron worked with Dartmouth.
Nice.
Okay. As well as with the ABC program.
Okay. And how, when talking about social life, so when you first got here, how was the making of friends and meeting people? I know you were on the football team, so was that a big part of like how you met a lot of other Black students or people in general?
Let's put it like this. When I came between the sophomore classes, junior classes, and senior classes, there were approximately 15 Black students among those three classes. My entering class, freshman class, the class of 1969, we had approximately 15 Black students. So we kind of doubled the Black population of Dartmouth from approximately 15 to 30. I'm talking about students, approximately 30 Black students out of a student population of 4,000.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how did you guys, how did you guys first start to like interact with each other? Was it natural? You were just like, oh, I'm Black, you're Black, let's be friends?
Well, there were only, based on my recollection, there were only three Black people on the football team, myself, Robert Bennett, and Al Sloan. I'm sorry, as well as maybe one or two upperclassmen. University was concerned. There were very few Black athletes of any sports at Dartmouth when we were there, when I was entering Dartmouth. It was a combination of seeing, running into students on campus, as well as the very few Black students that were playing sports.
Okay. So, as far as like other social life things, like, did you guys go to frats, fraternities, and do those types of things for social events?
Some did. You could become a member of a fraternity once you became a sophomore.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when, if you desire to be in a fraternity, that's when rush season began.
Okay.
You could be a guest at a fraternity house during your freshman year. It was a combination of many things, including getting rides out of Hanover to either Boston, New York City, Hartford, Smith, Mount Holyoke, etc. You have to recall that at that time, Dartmouth was an all-men's college, and there was also the closest junior college was called Colby Junior College, which was an all female junior college at that time.
I have heard about that school. A lot of, like, you guys would drive down there just like to meet girls and to be more social, because I know there were like no women here, especially Black women at that. So that makes sense. And then so you guys would like drive down there for social events and things like that. Did you feel like Dartmouth was an inclusive space? I know that's like a obvious question, but what was it like?
When you say inclusive space, what do you mean?
Did you feel like you had the opportunity, like if you wanted to interact with white people on campus, would you? Like, would it, you be comfortable?
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
Okay.
It,
nice.
It was both inclusive and subclusive. I remember when I got my first haircut at Dartmouth, I went to the barber shop and the barber kind of, his eyes got wide, and as he was cutting my hair, he told me he didn't know how to cut my kind of hair. When I came to Dartmouth, there was no fried chicken in the community.
Mm-hmm.
There was only one Black resident over. And that was the postman and his family.
Hmm.
I can't recall his name now, but there was only one Black family that lived in Hanover, New Hampshire.
Wow. Okay, so you feel like the space, like it was inclusive. You could talk to whoever you wanted to talk to, but like the things you needed as a Black person, like the food and other access to Black resources kind of weren't there.
They were not there. No.
Yeah. Okay.
The college of Box Clemente and Deserto was clearly operative when it came to at least myself,
mm-hmm.
the voice crying out in the wilderness.
Okay. Right. Okay. Well, that's good to know.
Anything as far as socially was concerned or culturally, you had to leave school. You had to leave the Hanover area.
Right. And it seems like we had to do a lot of the bringing in of that, of our own culture onto the campus. I'll get into that like a little bit. So also like just to reiterate, so you did feel like you could be included. It wasn't, no one was like actively trying to exclude you.
No one was actively trying to exclude you. And as far as the general population was concerned, there wasn't any type of overt efforts to try to include you either.
Right.
It was almost everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would get together periodically, you know, informally, like in the dining hall or as we ran into each other on campus, or one student would invite another student or group of students to their room. It was all informal, at least mm-hmm. during my freshman year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. So as far as having to like bringing your own culture to Dartmouth, I guess that's where like the AM comes in and things like that you guys started. So can you tell me a little bit more about bringing in the culture to Dartmouth?
Well, during my sophomore year, and the discussion started the latter part of my freshman year, we started talking about the benefits of developing an association. Mm-hmm. Because again, with our class, with the class of 69, we were coming toward a mini Christmas, and we were area of Black students on campus, and we were talking to each other that I think the next year, the class of 70, there were another 15 or 20 Black students that came in, but we were slowly edging towards some type of critical mass as well as consensus on what we as students of color at Dartmouth needed in our lives to make it better during our stay at Dartmouth. And that's how the notion of Afro-Am came up.
And what year was that for you, your freshman or sophomore?
The discussion began in my freshman year. I'd say that's the spring of my freshman year.
Okay. Okay. And how did that come about? I've heard some stories, some about how this one person took the initiative to invite all the Black students to some event. And then the more you guys like got organized and got to start to come together, how do you remember the experience?
There was an individual that did raise the issue, and there was an informal meeting that was called. I don't remember the specifics. Mm-hmm. It's been so long, but it's like a snowball that started out at the top of the hill, rolling down the hill. Mm-hmm. There was consensus. Mm-hmm. That we were all in the same situation, and we wanted a better student life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how involved were you in the AM?
I was one of the co-founders of the AM.
And this was in your freshman spring?
It was, as I indicated, the discussion began in the spring of my freshman year. Mm-hmm. But it really took a life onto itself in my sophomore year. That's what I can recollect. We're talking about. It occurred over 50 years ago.
Yeah, I understand. The details are probably hard to remember. So like just to be more general, so the overall goal of the AM originally was to have a space where you can bring Black students together.
Well, that yes, and not only to deal with concerns, but there was much happening across America in terms of raising the issues of equity and inclusion and the mass desegregation of people of color in America at that time. Mm-hmm. And so it was both for local concerns in terms of campus concerns and challenges, but also we felt a need to have a better connection with what was going on across America at the time.
Okay. So what type of things did you guys do to, you know, try to emphasize it?
Well, at first, it was recruitment as far as developing a membership base among ourselves. And I don't recall our having burning issues about any conditions at Dartmouth that some students of color had at other institutions. We weren't really against one specific issue, but we wanted our voices and concerns heard by somebody in general. We were we wanted to advocate and be part of the national discussion and dialogue that was happening at that time. That was the age of not only Dr. Martin Luther King, but also the other Black movements that were sprouting up in America. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to be discussions.
So, and how did you guys do that? Did you like reach out to different clubs and different organizations, put out newsletters?
Well, ultimately, and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, ultimately, we were networking with Black students and other surrounding colleges.
Okay.
There was a weekend, it was called the Soul Weekend at Yale, that I can recall we started going to, when I say we, myself started going to in my sophomore year years. And it kind of brought together the vast majority of Black students in the Northeast that were attending predominantly white colleges. There would be an annual convocation of those type of students in New Haven, Connecticut. So we were beginning to network and to see what other students of color were doing in their respective college environments.
Remember, you said about recruitment. I remember you telling me that you took one of your springs to go into to recruit students. What was that recruitment process like overall throughout your 4 years or even the spring term itself?
Well, I started recruiting students at the beginning of my junior year, and this was after the Wallace incident. The Wallace incident was a watershed, one of the watershed events of my Dartmouth, and that occurred during the 1967, which was toward the end of my sophomore year.
Okay, so let's see, we can go into the Wallace event and then you can tell me about the recruitment process. How about that?
Well, let me say this. Before the Wallace incident, my primary focus on campus was playing football.
Okay.
And I was also an officer of the Newman Club, which was the Catholic organization at Dartmouth, the Catholic student organization at Dartmouth, which was housed at the Aquinas House, which is at the end of Fraternity Row. Aquinas House was a Catholic church, or is a Catholic at Dartmouth. And the Newman Club was a student organization that was associated with, when I say the student organization, the Catholic student organization that emanated from the activities at Aquinas House, and I was one of the officers. So pre-Wallace incident, that was my focus, in addition to the creation of Afro-Am Society.
Okay. So you
which
had the
was primarily the initiative of the class of 1969 and 1970.
Okay. So when you, your main focus first up until your freshman year to junior year was football, the Newman Club, and the Afro-American Society.
Yes.
Okay. Awesome.
Now post Wallace incident, which was again in May of 1967, the first thing I did was quit the football team. I quit the football team at the end of my sophomore year, because I remember coming back that September, the beginning of my junior year, and the coaches were telling me, he said, you know, you could be first string, one of the starters this year. I was a defensive right end. But again, I said, no, I want to devote my non-academic time toward the recruitment of Black students.
Wow. Thank you for that.
And so that's what I did.
Okay.
And at that same time, in addition to on the weekends going down to Boston, which included Roxbury, et cetera, I would go to New York City and other parts of the Northeast to talk to prospective students. The other thing I did, there was an organization, and it really kind of goes back to the Yale Soul Weekends. It was an organization in New Haven called the Cooperative Program for Educational Opportunity, CPEO, which was a nonprofit organization that recruited on behalf of approximately, I'd say, 50 to 75 colleges across America. The Ivy League, Seven Sister, and many of the other private colleges, Stanford, the Oberlins, the Wash U University, like in St. Louis, the private schools and what,
et cetera.
It was it recruited students for organizations. Students, I'm talking about students of color, for these colleges. And I became active with CPEO also during my junior year. And I mentioned that because was primarily, its main supporter was Yale University. And beginning on right after my junior year, it transitioned its base from New Haven and Yale as its main supporter to the University of Chicago here in Chicago, Illinois, the University of Chicago being its main supporter. And I became the manager, CPEO's Chicago office and activities during the end of my junior year. I worked, that was my summer job, and I took off. I became a student of
study
or remote learning. My senior that my experience being the manager of CPEO and recruiting students was my term long project during the fall term of my and one of the staff of five people. We were on the campus of the University of Chicago. One of the things we did was organize the student conference that took place, I think it was in December of my senior year. We had 400 students at an all-day Saturday conference. And we had Nancy Wilson came in. She was one of the great, I don't know if you've ever heard of Nancy Wilson, given your generation, but she was a national star at that time. She came in and was one of the guest speakers.
Wow.
So that was my focus post Wallace incident.
Okay. So before the Wallace incident, like I said, you were working with Newman Club, Afro-Am, and you had quit the football team by this point because you wanted to focus on recruiting. So can you tell me about the Wallace incident? How that led up? What was the Afro-Am Society doing at the time? And what did
Well, the Wallace incident was not an Afro-Am sponsored event. That's number one.
Yeah.
That was not on the agenda of the Wallace incident, in terms of the Wallace incident. It grew out of informal discussions among a few Black students. The Student Government Association invited to, and at the time, just as background, George Wallace, who was the governor of Alabama some years earlier, had physically blocked the entrance to the University of Alabama to prevent Black students from entering that university. And he stood on the steps of the University of Alabama and said, segregation today, segregation forever. It got to the point where federal troops had to be called in. President Eisenhower had to call in federal troops to help in the desegregation of the University of Alabama, or to provide a safe presence for Black students to attend classes in that community. It was one of the watershed moments of the civil rights movement, especially in the late 50s and early 60s. Governor Wallace was running to be Democratic nominee for president leading up to the 1968 presidential election. And at that time, New Hampshire was the first state in America for the presidential primaries. Today, it's Wisconsin, today it's Iowa. But at that time, it was New Hampshire. And so that was kind of like the backdrop of what was going on when the Dartmouth Student Government Association invited Governor Wallace to speak. It was May 7, 1967. It was the weekend. It was the beginning Green Key weekend. He was invited to speak on a Thursday evening, and Green Key weekend started the next day. So there was, at least at that time, during the springtime, Green Key Weekend was the watershed weekend of that term, much like Winter Carnival is a watershed activity, social act during the winter term at Dartmouth. And the venue was Webster Hall. And we had there were some meetings, informal meetings of blacks, of the black students. And it, again, this time there was no more than 30 of us on campus. And there were some informal meetings in my room and a few other rooms. And our goal was to we wanted to do something that would let people across America, especially people of color across America, know that the few black folks at Dartmouth, the black students at Dartmouth, were not complacent. Mm-hmm. We wanted to signal to the black communities across America that we were the movement for change. And when I say change, I'm talking about desegregation, economic opportunity, et cetera, as opposed to just part of a small group of students happy to be where we were. Mm-hmm. And really a life of its own. That was our overall goal, was to raise the issues and to signal to Americans, especially Black America, that we just weren't happy to be students in the Ivy League and for that opportunity. And when I say things took on a life of their own, at one point the rules were constantly changing around that event, to the point where, for example, you could only put forth questions in writing to the panel that was going to interact with his opening remarks. You could only put your comments in writing. As before, at the beginning of the activity, there was no protocol as far as the of questions. And so we were doing things on the fly. The other condition was that there was no signage, either outside or inside Webster Hall. I think Webster Hall today is called Rauner Hall. And ironically, Rauner, Bruce Rauner, is one of the former governors of Illinois. He was class, I think, of 1978 at Dartmouth. The further irony is that my daughter was his capital markets director, Bruce Rauner. And she went on to become the current governor of Illinois' capital markets director. That means that she was responsible for debt money in the state of Illinois, as well as managing its $27 billion portfolio. But that's another story. But the bottom line was, given the changing rules, we were determined to reach with that in mind. We made signs in out of pillow and bed linens. There used to be, I don't know what it is now, but there used to be a service called Keen Laundry Service, which supplied towels and sheets to its subscribers, the student subscribers. I think it was on a weekly basis. So we made signs like, you killed my brother. Can you walk on water too? Et cetera. We just made different signs. And if you look at any pictures of us during the Wallace incident, you'll notice that we had on sweaters or coats. Our signs underneath our coats. We arrived at the venue, I guess about an hour, 45 minutes to an hour earlier. There were about, I guess, 15 or 19 of us spread down the venue. When I say the venue, Webster, at that time, Webster around her hall. I was one of about five or six people that was in the first, I don't know, four or five rows center. And as we entered the hall, there was national media, local and national media. And I can remember, this was my first some of the cameramen were sitting on the floor aiming up at us to make us look bigger than what we actually were. At the beginning, when as the event started, we periodically would get up and flash our signs. And that caused the audience, in the general audience. And again, this was Green Key weekend, and some students had already started to get into the holiday mode with their drinking, et cetera. So they were kind of boisterous. After about, I guess, 15 or 20 minutes of disrupting his speech and periodically flashing signs, the general uproar, the students, especially where we were in terms of the front of the, can you see me? I lost the picture. Not okay, you're back now. We decided to leave the hall, and when we went outside, Robert Bennett started talking. There was a crowd that kind of came out with us. And when we were outside, Robert and others of us, we ultimately, after some discussion, we ultimately decided that we were going to go back in and march around the hall and come back out.
The door is locked.
All the doors were locked on us, but I guess through the grace of God, there was one student who from the Baker Library. When I say one student, one white student that was walking from the Baker Library who wanted to enter Webster Hall, and a policeman, one of the handlers, opened the door. He was the door, and the policeman cracked, and he saw this student, so he opened the door to let this particular student in, and I overpowered the door to the point where it was wide open. And so that allowed the students from the outside to go back in into the hall, including myself. When we got back into the hall, Wallace stepped back from the podium. his Alabama police guard came to the forefront of the podium with their, I don't remember if they drew their guns or put their hands on their guns, but they did come out to the front of the podium. The event stopped immediately. Wallace was taken to some undisclosed area. I don't know where he was taken. And we did march around. The event halted, or they put a pause on the event, and we came on out. Some of us went back to my room. Again, my room was very close to Webster Hall, me being in Mass Hall, at 112 Mass Hall, where we got rid of our signs and other paraphernalia. And we went back, by the time we went back to in front of Webster Hall, there had been an attempt to restart his talk. But that had been, that notion was out the window. And so the next decision,
he needed to
exit and just get in his car and leave. But by that time, the students were sufficiently aroused. And when I say the students, these were the white students, because again, even if you counted all the black students, that was 30. Not all the black students at Dartmouth were part of this. And say 20, but there were maybe 100 or 200 students that had been aroused and were shouting against Wallace. When they finally were able to get him into his car, the students were rocking the car. The students were rocking his car. But they were finally able to forge a path to get him out of town. The reported event was not only local, it was not only national, it was international. Because again, this was the backdrop of a presidential, a would-be presidential candidate.
Run out of town.
And this activity, I'm told, was reported in the UK newspapers. What I do know, it was in addition to the Hanover papers and the local papers, it was in the New York Times, both Eric Severi and other reporters included this in their newscasts. It was in the Chicago Tribune, it was in the LA Times, and many other country, the incident that had occurred. There were many alumni from the South that one of the people that were responsible for the Wallace Institute to be expelled. And there were, I didn't realize there were such vicious comments that were made, that were sent into the school. And I know that and it just sent me some things a few months ago with sending them to other black alumni in terms of letters, copies of letters to the school, as well as were addressed to black students in general. And it was somewhat of a raucous time at Dartmouth.
Wow. During that period.
Now, the Wallace incident was a catalyst for many of the positive changes that came about at Dartmouth. It was, I think the administration was shaken to its core, given the fact that it became both a national and international story. We had such good people as Forrester Lee or Woody Lee, as well as some of the other, few of the other students that were trying to articulate and eloquently our concerns and motivations to the administration, because the administration was just totally about what the events that had unfolded.
So this Wallace event, it made it easier for you guys to kind of initiate things that you wanted to implement in the campus.
Yes, Bill McCurran and Woody Lee. Bill McCurran was class of 1969, who went on to become a Rhodes Scholar, who was vice president of the, I think he was vice president at the time of the Student Government Association. They were some of the primary spokesmen, informal spokesmen, answering the questions, well, how could something like this happen, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And basically what I'm saying is that when I look back on what happened that night, it was, there was, in my mind, prevention. None of us ever envisioned, when I say none of us, the Black students that were part of the initiators of this action, we did not envision having the things happen that happened, as far as physical running George Wallace out of town, or having students to rock his car, etc. When I say rock, I'm talking about shaking his car. We did not envision those kind of things happening, but they happened. And the other part, no one got hurt. Mm-hmm. So that was, the incident, administration to listen to Black students seriously, we were able to develop meaningful budgets. For example, not financially, but having a place, a better place. The Shabazz Center came about. Mm-hmm. The Tucker Foundation, in addition to the college, developed budgets, specific budgets to recruit more Black students and students of color. Mm-hmm. The Black students like myself, there were, I guess, at least a half a dozen or more Black students that became more proactive in terms of recruitment of more Black students. Instead of listening to the notion of, well, we tried and we couldn't find any more Black students, et cetera, we went out ourselves and with the college's support, staff support, as well as financial support. For example, I finished up a term early because during the summers I would take one or two summer classes at like DePaul University in Chicago. So I had enough credits to graduate a term early. And what would have been my last term at Dartmouth, term of 1969, I used that time a quote-unquote independent study, but I worked in conjunction with the admissions department and I visited over a dozen cities in the east. I'm sorry, in the east, Midwest, and South. I'm talking about from Jersey City, New Jersey, Newark, New Jersey, New York City, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, obviously Chicago, Detroit, St. Louis, Milwaukee, Nashville, Atlanta, Columbia, South Carolina, Cincinnati, and others that elude me at the moment, like 2 to 3 weeks at the time. And I had an assistant that assisted me. Well, she made up the appointment. She made the appointments.
Mm-hmm.
So Dartmouth gave me a couple credit cards and a pocket full of money. Mm-hmm. And I was out on the road 2 or 3 weeks at the time.
Wow. And how did you find, sorry, how did you find these students?
I went to, the scheduled visit was at, visits were at high schools. I talked to sophomores and juniors at high schools in those cities.
Mm.
And if in fact that there were, there was a some seniors that had been accepted at Dartmouth, I would also, and I was in the same city, I would also arrange to meet with them and their parents.
Mm.
And occasionally I would have dinner with a Dartmouth alum.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So you did that in your off term.
Matter of fact,
yeah, so is yours. Oh, is it back now?
Ms. Ramsey, okay, now you're back.
Yeah.
Matt,
I did that finally decided to go to
Amherst Tough School. And mm-hmm. I also did some recruitment at Tough School.
Mm. Okay. And so
1971 with my MBA at Amherst Tough.
Oh, I see. And the Tucker Foundation, is that specifically to recruit back students?
No, the Tucker Foundation, their mission was to be a catalyst for the different social issues of the day at Dartmouth. It wasn't, there was clearly not its mission when it started to recruit Black students. And the Tucker Foundation, they provided some of the monies as well as the staff support in conjunction to recruit more Black. I don't know if the Tucker Foundation still exists, but I'm sure there's a lot on the campus about the Tucker Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They had an office at about a half a block from the center of campus.
Mm.
Okay. They were across the street from Cass and Gauntlet, or diagonally across the street from the Hanover Inn. Building there on the corner.
Mm-hmm.
that's closest to the Connecticut River.
Okay. Were you also a part of ABC?
I was a tutor.
Okay.
At ABC. The ABC program in Hanover, generally the ABC program operated with private high schools, in conjunction with private high schools, but the ABC program in Hanover was the first program that operated in conjunction with public high schools, which was Hanover High School.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay.
I was a tutor.
And were those
one of our students was Jesse Spikes, who went on to become a Rhodes Scholar.
And was that specifically for Black students or?
The ABC program, it stood for a Better Chance program.
Mm-hmm.
And was specifically for people of color. You would have to Google it. But
yeah,
all the ABC students I ever saw were people of color.
Yeah, we collected some information at the Rahner Library, and we learned a bit about ABC, and it is initially for Black students and people of color. And I know there's still many ABC programs all over. So. That's good. Mm-hmm. Okay. I know that you're like in broadcasting. Were you interested? I know Dartmouth at the time did have like a radio station club. But were you interested in broadcasting at the time at Dartmouth at all?
No.
Okay.
It's something that never entered my mind when I was in college.
Okay.
When I graduated with my MBA from Amos Tuck School at Dartmouth, first of all, at that time, there was a 3-2 program where you could do 3 years undergrad and 2 years at Amos Tuck. Since I was undecided about my future career, I did not take advantage of the 3-2 program. I was at 4 years undergrad and 2 years at Amos Tuck. So I lived in Hanover for 6 years, not five. When I was in my senior year, it was the winter term of my senior year. I went down to Tuck School and met with the dean. His name was John Hennessy, and shared with him that I would like to have a job in the business atmosphere in Chicago for the upcoming summer. So he got on the phone and subsequently contacted three Chicago alumni. Two were bankers, vice presidents at banks, and one was Dave McLaughlin, the president of Champion. Mr. McLaughlin went on to become the president of Dartmouth. And after he was the chairman of the American Red Cross. And he died while he was the chairman of the American Red Cross. I went to see, during my spring break, I went to see all three gentlemen. One person in particular, well, the two vice presidents, one was of Harris Bank from the First National Bank of Chicago, which is now known as Chase. The gentleman that I went to see at Harris Bank, he walked me upstairs to an accounting firm called Pete Marwick Mitchell and Company, which is now known as KPMG. He introduced me to Charles Davison, who was a Dartmouth, I don't remember, 1950-something, who was the partner in charge of that office. offered me a summer position as an assistant auditor. I had never had a course in accounting in my life. So what happened was, the day after I graduated from Dartmouth, I was to start a two-week course in Washington, D.C. at the Institute that was located at the Watergate Hotel. There was a monsoon rain the day of my graduation. Matter of fact, Nelson Rockefeller, who went on to become Vice President of the United States, was a guest speaker, and the whole graduation ceremony had to be moved back to the early evening into the gymnasium. I did not get out of Hanover until late that Sunday night. Again, it was big rains. I got down to New York City driving about 2 a.m. that morning and got some sleep. Didn't get to Washington, D.C. driving until about 6 p.m. that Monday, which meant a whole day of class. When I came in that night, that Monday night, and met with the school officials, they shook their head. They did know that the weather had been bad because it had been bad in Washington, D.C. also. But they said, on Friday at 12 noon, we're given on head from this moment, which is Monday night, until 12 noon on Friday, like 3.5 days from now, to learn a semester worth of accounting. Because at 12 noon, we're going to give a test. So I learned a semester worth of accounting in 3.5 days. I got something like an 80.
Wow.
Day. And the next week, it was a semester worth of auditing, but there was not going to be a test on the auditing. I lived at the Watergate, and this is the same Watergate that people know in conjunction with former President Nixon, the breaking Democratic headquarters. I for 2 weeks, right after my June 1969 graduation. Then I drove from there to Chicago during that summer with Pete Marwick. They started me out and working on some worldwide billings audits for Borg Warner. But there were also I did an audit with Schwinn Bicycle Company. Schwinn Bicycle started here in Chicago. But the most interesting part of that summer was that I was sent out to Joliet State Prison for 2 weeks on an inventory observation. That was a state prison. No, I was in two prisoners. The prisoners made furniture and other things for the state. I had to have lunch with the guards, and if I had to eat the food that I ate with the guards, I would probably be 100 pounds lighter. I had to be in prison by 8 o'clock, and Joliet is about 30 miles. And if I did not get out by 4:30, I would have to spend the night in prison. Suffice it to say, I always got out 30. And the most depressing part of that experience was when you go in, one door opens and you go in, and before you can go to the next door, the door that you just went through has to be locked. Up another door. And so that was like of going into hell. And after, I guess, about a week, I asked one of the guards, I said, well, Joe Blow, who's working with me, seems like a nice guy. How long has he been here? He said, 18 years. I said, for what? Murder. And an unintentional viewpoint of the criminal justice system. Let's leave it like that. But the important part is that it taught me accounting. That summer, I became familiar with accounting and auditing. When I went to Tuck, primary course, so to settle into course. Matter of fact, during my vacation periods, or at least some of them, during the springtime and another summer, I worked for like Smith, Batchelor, and Rugg, which was a Norwich, Vermont accounting firm, sometimes during my vacation period as well. On Christmas, I would come back and work with Pete Marwick. So it allowed me to develop a source of income. Now, the summer between my first and second year of MBA school, I worked with First National Bank of Chicago. I wanted to get the banking experience. And I ultimately, after I graduated, I went with First National of Chicago. Mm-hmm. Ironically, the chairman of the First National Bank of Chicago at that time was a Dartmouth alum. And I made officership, became a full-fledged officer of that institution about 2 years after I joined. And I ultimately became executive vice president of one of the black-owned banks in Chicago. The bank was interested in broadcasting, and he invited me into his group to buy a radio station whose license was being challenged in Gary, Indiana. We ultimately worked out an arrangement to buy that station. The FCC was suing that station, with WLTH, for certain improprieties as part of its license renewal. They weren't decided not to renew the license of that station until the mayor of Gary came before the FCC, the last administrative hearing, and indicated that turning that station dark would represent a hardship to the northwestern region of Indiana, especially since it was going through trials in the steel industry at that time. Mm-hmm. And this weighs into the importance of voting. Benjamin Hooks, he was a reverend, and he was the first black person that was selected by former president at the FCC. At that last hearing, of that meeting was Wiley, FCC Chairman Wiley. He indicated that he saw no reason why this particular station should not be turned dark. And generally, when a station turns dark, there's a process where companies can bid, apply for that frequency, and usually takes 5 to 7 years to award frequency to another group. Mm-hmm. And Chairman Wiley said, I'm in favor of pulling the license. Chairman Hooks said, we've just heard from the mayor of Gary, a hardship to the people of his region, and the law. and Hook said, well, that's why we're commissioned decisions based upon not only the law, but the prevailing conditions of the time.
Mm-hmm.
About 30 days later, the chairman wanted to make do a favor for a broadcaster in somewhere in the East, and said, if you want to do a favor over here, over there, you got to do a favor over here in Gary. Mm-hmm. So the FCC on May the 11th, 1977, and the reason why I remember that date, it also coincides to with the birth of my first child, Kelly. The FCC ruled that it would renew the license of this particular station, WLTH, with the understanding that it sell to our group within 60 days. Because at that time, an owner could not sell himself or herself out of trouble. If the FCC initiated action or investigated to where you would really things that is being taken away from you. You just couldn't sell the station under those circumstances because the FCC would not approve a new owner. So that's how I got to broadcasting. It was not anything that was pre-planned or a lifetime dream. It's where opportunity met preparation and hard work.
Right. What does WLPH stand
for? Pardon me?
Sorry, what does WLPH stand for?
WLTH, those are the call letters.
Okay.
It's an AM station.
Okay.
And it's still in Gary, Indiana. We went on and bought over 20 years. We owned 8 radio stations in 5 states. But more importantly, our situation at WLTH, as far as the litigation, FCC, it was FCC versus North Broadcast.
That was the legal proceeding
against the radio station. Against the alleged violence of the radio station, that case became the legal precedent for the FCC's adoption of the distress sale policy that led to more people being able to buy radio stations. Or put it another way, when we bought WLTH, there were less than 25, there were between 20 and 30 black-owned radio stations in America. And as a result of the adoption of the distress sale policy, where if circumstances were such, the station could be sold to another group, especially a group that had minority representation. And as a result, over a 20-year period, there were maybe 125 black-owned radio stations during that period. I went on to become the chairman of the National Association of Black-Owned Broadcasters. The Wall Street Journal did an article of page 1 with picture article on me on September 23, 1987. And the reason why I remember that date is because the day before, September 22, is my birthday.
Wow. So when did WYLD come in?
We bought WYLD in March of 1980. and closed on WLTH. We closed on that on, I think it was June 30, 1977. I was the youngest member of our ownership group by at least 17 years. Mm-hmm. So partners kind of turned to me that I was younger than the next person. I was from 17 to 35 years younger than my partners. Mm. They all turned to me and said, "You learned the business," because one of my partners was a former mayor of Gary and was a county. Another one was Harry. He was a CBS and then ultimately ABC News reporter and anchor here in Chicago. For 3 years, I worked 50 to 60 hours a week at the bank because I was the head of the loan department. And I worked 20 to 25 hours a week, which was 35 miles away from the bank. Mm-hmm. So I did for no pay, just learning the business, the broadcasting business. And when we bought WLTH AM and FM in New Orleans, 1980, I got out of the banking business to be in the broadcasting business full, because we bought WLTH for $190,000. And again, that brought out the importance of banking with Black-owned banks. No white banks would loan us the money, even though in our group we had a bank president, we had a former mayor. Make any difference.
No white banks would loan us
any money to buy that station. It was Seaway Bank of Chicago, a Black-owned bank that don't loan us the money to buy our first radio station. So what I'm saying is voting was important, because if there had been no Ben Hooks that was appointed by President Carter, we would have probably never gotten into the broadcast business. And secondly, doing business with Black-owned institutions was important, because that's where we got our first loan from. Our New Orleans stations, our FM was 100,000 watts. Our AM was 10,000 watts. The purchase price was $2.25 million. Mm-hmm. And Walter Heller loaned us the money to buy those at a high interest rate. And after about 3 years, our FM, we were the number one FM in the region.
Wow. And do you think those banks didn't loan to you because it was Black owned and they didn't want to support like Black owned radio stations?
During that period of time, it was very for any white banks generally weren't lending to Black businesses, and especially startups.
Right.
Even though we had the collateral. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever heard of Johnson Ultra Sheen, yes. Afro Sheen, et cetera. George Johnson, who's about 96 years old, still tells a story of the fact that in the 50s, he went in, the mid-1950s, he went in to get a loan to start his business, his hair care business, his hair manufacturing business. He was trying to get, I think it was 200 or 200. They turned him down for that. They turned him down. And then he went back to a different bank and said that he wanted a loan of $200 to $250 to take a vacation. So the bank loaned him money to take a vacation, but not to start a business.
Wow. Do you think that's still like prevalent today? I mean,
yes. There's probably more in the light of recent events, including Trayvon Martin, et cetera. There's more outreach, more efforts, but it is still having access to capital is still one of the barriers of being a Black business person.
Right, I agree.
What you really need to function.
Right, and it seems like the best way to do that is to reach out to other Black banks and Black firms who are willing to support other Black-owned businesses and other Black people who are willing to support.
Yes, and now you have, with the rise of the internet, you now have access to crowdfunding.
Mm-hmm.
That is challenging.
True. Yeah, I agree. So what are your current impressions of Dartmouth now? I don't know when the last time you've been here, but are there any things that you've like noticed over time that are interesting or anything like that?
I think, and people commented to me about the fact that there seems to be a much stronger alumni presence at Dartmouth than many colleges, especially through BATA.
Yes.
What to me is somewhat distressing is that I don't know if present Dartmouth students have a full appreciation on the sacrifices that many of the earlier Black Dartmouth students had for Dartmouth to evolve to where it is today. But many of the challenges that exist today 30, 40 years ago in terms of the challenges of faculty recruitment, of faculty advancement, sensitizing white faculty about the importance of not only Black faculty, but
the Black life.
In terms of the Black students' experiences before they came to Dartmouth. When I was at Dartmouth, there was no bridge program. That's one of the things that shortly a year or two after I graduated, that started up. But I think the students,
especially the Black
alumni, that they better utilize in terms of potential summer employment or projects or just career advice. Because there's 4,000 now or more. And to me, that's a base, it's a resource base.
Mm-hmm.
The same way that you have to look at what you have, because when I was a student at Dartmouth and I was thinking about employment, I said, well, let me go down and talk to the dean of the Dartmouth Business School. To me, that was a resource.
Mm-hmm.
And I there were very few Black alumni. I guess when I was like a sophomore or junior at Dartmouth, I don't know, there was probably less than 100 Black alumni going back to 18, whatever. I think 1853. So it's not like I could just pick up the phone and tap that base, because it didn't exist. But today it does exist.
What can you say that your experience at Dartmouth like taught you, like overall, if anything?
Persistence. Mm-hmm. Also, there's a motto. It's there are many roads.
Did you get there?
Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, Dartmouth kind of taught how to be resourceful.
Okay. And any life advice in general outside of Dartmouth, I guess it can be inside of Dartmouth, but something that you would like students to know that now, at this time, something that they should like keep in mind or anything like that?
Well, in some regard, some of the old adages in terms of voting, mm-hmm. in terms of in terms of networking. Mm-hmm. Also, career education. That's one of the that I was always so involved. In addition to our broadcast business, we also own $2 renters. One in Cleveland. We were at both downtown New Orleans and downtown Cleveland. And for a few years, we also had, we owned the Savannah Cardinals. It was a minor league baseball team in Savannah, Georgia. Mm-hmm. So I was always running between our various businesses and didn't take full advantage of keeping abreast in terms of my professions. And now with the internet, and courses, it's easier. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I learned, well, not too late, but later on, was balance, mm-hmm. in terms of having a balanced life and mm-hmm. doing something on a daily basis. From especially once when I was banking as well as broadcasting, I rarely took a vacation. I was working 80 hours a week, generally 6 to 7 days a week, and I with my family. Mm-hmm. And partly because my life was out of balance. Mm-hmm. And once I got it in balance, I think that helped to get me up to the age that I am now. Last month, I celebrated my 75th birthday. My sister.
Right, like I was running. Yeah. I probably
would have been 20 years ago. So, and I remember, there's two things I remember that elderly gentlemen who were very successful in business told me. One is Mr. Rhodes Funeral Home. It's a funeral home that started up in like the 1880s and still exists in New Orleans and Louisiana. Mr. Roach used to, by his example, he used to do something pleasurable on a daily basis. What was going on in his business companies, his livery business, funeral home business. He would do something pleasurable, go to the racetrack, do something pleasurable on a daily basis. Number two, we had a customer in New Orleans, part owner of a furniture store. His name was Mr. Loves. And he liked to be in commercials on TV and radio. One day I stopped by one of his stores. He used to wear a 10-gallon hat with a long cigar. And we were talking about some of the challenges of the day. And he sat back and he took a long puff on his cigar. And he said, young man, happening has neither nor wheels. You have to make it happen. You can't rely on anybody else. You have to make it happen. Mm-hmm. Part of the solution and not continue as part of the problem. And so those are things that I try to subscribe to on a daily basis. I'm lots of time with my group. I've got three grandsons. I just came back from Houston this past week, watching my play soccer and watching my play touch football. And I pick up my 5-year-old grandson here in Chicago 2 days a week from school, taking to some of his tennis lessons, taking to some of his social skills classes, or just do something with it. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I try to do now.
Nice. Okay, and last question to wrap it up. Why do you think it's important for Black students to attend Dartmouth?
Dartmouth, first of all, going to a college is almost like trying to select a group. Mm-hmm. It has to fit. Not everybody's cut out to go to a Dartmouth. Not everybody's cut out to college. It depends on the individual in terms of they're seeing something in the vast offerings at Dartmouth. I think Dartmouth was one of the early leaders with it. President Kent, as well as the Kiewit, the Peter Kiewit system. There used to be a computer across campus, which in the 1960s was revolutionary, for example. Generally, Dartmouth has been open to change and has been willing to take on new challenges through the decade. One thing that I always urge students to look at is a college's graduation rate, and Dartmouth is above 95%, as well as the alumni network. My first two or three jobs were through the assistant of Dartmouth alum, and I still tap Dartmouth alum today at age 75. Question about something or need XYZ advice or resource, I can always a Dartmouth alum to give me some advice or steer me in the right direction. And I think overall that's been invaluable, as well as it's and experiences.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, James. I really appreciate this interview. That's everything that I have. I have a lot of information. So this exhibit is going to be basically all about you and your experience at Dartmouth. I'll let you know when it's finished. It's going to have, would you happen to have like any photos from the time that you may be able to send through email? or no?
I'd have to look because I'm a victim. I'm a survivor of Hurricane Katrina.
My house
and everything was destroyed in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. I had 18-foot storm surges in my house. My water level was at 10 feet. I had to throw out everything in the house. I had to take my first floor down to the studs. And water stayed in my house for 2 months. Because New Orleans bowl. It's below sea level.
Wow.
So pictures I do not have.
Okay, that's fine. We have some at the, we may have some at like the Rauner Library. They have a lot of history there too. So if I have any more questions, I might like shoot you a text or something, or maybe we can like schedule a phone call if I have like some few questions about.
Feel free to call me.
Okay, awesome.
Feel free to call me.
Okay. Well, thank you so much again. I really appreciate it. Oh, we can start the interview.
Oh, well, thank you for taking the time.
Of course.